On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
We're talking to Eddie Curran, who is the author of The Governor of Goat Hill, Don Siegelman, the reporter who exposed his crimes, and the hoax that suckered some of the top names in journalism. Tell us how you got interested in the case that became this cause célèbre.
First of all, as I like to tell people, in case they think I was out for Siegelman, which certainly wasn't the case, I did a lot of stories on the James administration. His highway director went to prison.
Right.
I did a lot, and I didn't think I could do more stories on a governor. But I was always based in Mobile, not Montgomery, so it's not like I was always a Montgomery reporter.
Right, right.
And I really didn't do any stories to speak of, certainly not anything real investigative, on the Siegel administration for the first 2 years of his term. I got a tip, it was January, it's a long time ago, 2001, that which would have been really the start of his second half of his term, that had to do with the building of the new Honda facility up in Talladega County.
Right.
Been given a no-bid contract that ballooned to like $36 million, and all these road builders were mad as heck, and the same group of Siegelman friends, whatever, were going to get the Mercedes expansion in Tuscaloosa, and all the road builder community was very upset that they weren't bidding this work. I did that story.
And why weren't they bidding the work? This is the beginning of the as I'm reading the book, thinking, what? How did they get away with this?
Well, there was a little bitty tweak in the incentives law. Like, if it's a highway department contract, that sort of work has to be bid by
right.
law. You know, there's certain things like engineering or legal work that don't have to be bid and really shouldn't have to be bid. You should have a competitive process, but certain things the bid law requires. But there was like this little loophole in the law for the incentives project where you do things to bring Honda, Mercedes to, you know, and
big industries.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they kind of went through this loophole to the surprise of many and didn't really. Actually, a guy named Dana Byerly had written something about it when the contract first came out.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the first contract was like for 800 and something thousand, and they kind of presented that as the end of it. And then when I came along a year later, it had bloomed to about 36 million, and there were lots and lots of records. And what I want to do is give the story of what it's like to be a reporter doing these. You know, I could have just done a book where I just mashed together all my stories. There were so many stories. That would have been very long.
Yeah.
But I want the readers to know kind of how I found things, because I find it interesting, you know, the process or something happened and this led to this. It's almost like, you know, if I hadn't seen this, I wouldn't have seen that. And so
right.
you kind of learn about, and there are lots of scandals that have separate sets of facts and personalities. That's why I have a big list of players beginning to help people keep track. But the Honda story really led to some political hullabaloo. You know, the Republicans, the legislature, the minority at the time, made huge things about the bid law. And Siegelman, he ended up not giving the Mercedes contract to his friends and actually bidding it. But during that process, there was something related to the Honda case where, and they just lied to me on a bunch of things. And I knew they lied to me because I would see records and they would tell me one thing and I would go back and I would see something completely different. That made me suspicious. I could go on and on, but what the title of the book is called The Governor of Goat Hill. And Goat Hill is the sort of namesake of where the legislator operates. You know, that was built on an old goat pasture.
Right.
And this involved a tip I had about a lot of times, like I say in the book, you get a tip, but that's only the tip of the iceberg. Really.
Right.
You don't
right.
know, or I thought the tip that led to the GH construction scandal would, I thought maybe it'd go be one little story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't, and the more I dug into it, I find out this company is secretly owned by a guy named Lanny Young, who was a huge supporter of Siegelman, the best friend of his chief of staff, Paul Hammer. He did a lot of work for waste management, crooked sort of work,
right.
not officially for waste management, but he was a consultant, and he bribed some people in Cherokee County, and
right.
he would later go to prison for that, well, be found guilty of that. But this warehouse thing, I found all sorts of irregularities, including some bills paid for work that wasn't done and was never going to be done.
Right.
One of them was $90,000, but the bill was actually more like $300,000-something. And it turned out they ultimately canceled the whole project. I sent them a list of questions, and they even said they were going to sell $21 million worth of bonds. And one of these warehouses was going to be ABC, it was going to be the new center of the liquor, or where every bottle of bourbon
was all going to be warehoused at this place.
Yeah, they were going to move it from another place in Montgomery to this
right
one of these two warehouses they were building. And really, the Siegel administration had not even publicly told anyone really that they were building these warehouses. When I first heard about the warehouses, I called the ABC board. Their lawyer said, "I don't know what you're talking about." Called the ADECA, the agency, you know, the famous pork agency,
right?
Always been, and they're supposed to say, "We're not building any warehouses. I couldn't even get anybody to, and finally I had to just keep fighting for the truth. You know, really, it was like, well, I know they're building warehouses, and even their spokespeople are saying, we're not even building the warehouses. Forget the fact that they've hired this fake company that was going to get about $2.4 million on the project, and as it turns out, was not even going to be permitted to work on the project for reasons are explained in the book. That was the first big scandal, and kind of 2 days after our story on that, the FBI called me. They wanted to see my records. I couldn't give them to them. And then Bill Pryor announced a state criminal federal investigation, which is ultimately what led and expanded, involved some guilty pleas, including of Lanny Young, the GH Construction guy, Nick Bailey, who was Siegelman's man Friday, was with him all the time. Right.
And as it turns out, pretty much his fall guy, too. He ends up signing papers that it's obvious he had no interest in, and they had no reason to have signed them. But he's the official signee guy, so that puts his neck on the chopping block and not someone else's.
Yeah. He was Siegelman's driver, flunky. I call him, he's like Mikey. Remember the Life cereal where, let Mikey try it?
Yeah.
Siegelman would get Nick to sign things or do things where Nick really kind of took the blame for a lot of things where he was just, yes, sir, yes, boss, I'll do
yeah.
it. And even later, even now, Siegelman will blame things on Nick Bailey that even the records and everybody knows Bailey did it under his direction, but that's one of my big issues with Siegelman. As much as anything else, after all these years, he's a very friendly guy, engaging. But not only does he not ever say, I did wrong, it's always, I was victimized by others.
It's somebody else's fault.
It's always somebody else's fault.
Right. It's always an excuse, never admission of guilt at all.
The closest he'll come is, I hired the wrong people. And a lot of the things were just him, like the sale of his house for twice its value. Through a straw man. That didn't have anything to do with his employees. If you were to have Siegelman here today and ask him about the house, he would either not talk about it or would say, said enough about that. It's not that they paid what it was worth. One reason the book is pretty long is that there are these separate scandals, like the GH Construction has nothing to do with the sale of Siegelman's house to Birmingham trawler Lanny Vines.
Other than the fact that there are many of the same players rotate among the different scenes that we see. I started making a list of all of the different scandals and stories that you had to chase down that end up being all part of a larger picture. One of them was Siegelman's house. One of them was GH Construction, which stands for Goat Hill, of course.
Yeah.
One of them was using the Alabama Firefighters College as basically a money laundering. That was pretty intriguing.
Well, now, I didn't.
But that's just another part of the puzzle. And to me, a lot of these things sound like we've got a lot of money that we'd like to transfer from one place to another, but we can't do it legally. So let's dummy up something. The Phantom Foundation, the Alabama Education Lottery Association.
Now,
I loved that because, and this was kind of the beginning of a long trail that you pulled. You discovered that somebody had made a donation to a foundation that officially had been closed 2 years earlier.
Yeah.
And you wondered, how do you give money to something that no longer exists? Why do you give money to something that no longer exists?
And that was actually kind of a long tale. And the book is, Scrooge's a pretty big character in the book, because he's a national figure, and also wrote about his past and also his HealthSouth scandal, where he certainly should have been found guilty, I think. The Lottery Foundation, which has been so misreported by Siegelman and his supporters, is, well, if I'm guilty of this, just anybody who gives a regular campaign contribution can be put in jail. A regular campaign contribution, the public knows or can know about it because it's filed and closed to the Secretary of State.
Right.
And this one also had to be disclosed to the IRS. This and other ones, it wasn't disclosed to the IRS either because it was a foundation. Working on a completely separate story about stories the Birmingham News broke about state agencies that had to use, really were forced by Siegelman, the Siegelman administration, to use Siegelman's own stockbroker to manage state funds. I was kind of following them up and competing with them on that story when I came across a donation by this PAC that was for $13,500 to the Lottery Foundation. It was made 2 years after the referendum was in 1999. That at the end of the year, they disclosed they spent $5 million on the referendum, raised $5 million, spent $5 million, balance of zero. The newspaper reported that the foundation has been closed. The foundation actually filed a piece of paper at the Secretary of State.
Indicating that they were out of business now.
Yeah, we're officially no longer.
Dissolved.
Here I go, 2 years later, I'm working on this other story, and I find this pack is given to the foundation. And it was like, and I told him, I asked my boss, can we write a separate story on this next week? It was like a back page story, And they wouldn't explain it. And Foundations are also supposed to, it gets kind of complicated, but I try to tell the reader, the process. What I had to go through to get from this little $13,500 contribution, how I came across it, and then what I had to go through, like 4 months worth of stories. And essentially, I had to build my case in the paper to the point where the Secretary of State and the Attorney General's office ordered the foundation, which was really controlled by Siegelman, to disclose its donors, which it had been fighting not to do. And among those was HealthSouth, $250,000, and a company called Integrated Health from Maryland, which was another $250,000, and they were a near bankrupt Maryland company. And that's a whole separate part. Krushy had something to do with that. That's almost another story I could.
And apparently, what happens is the governor goes in and more or less extorts money from these people and says, but he goes in and says, you know, if you want to do business in the state, you're going to chip in this amount of money into the lottery fund.
Well, that's what he did with Scrooge.
Yeah.
And he did it with a lot of. I'm always hearing stories. Well, Eddie, you should have. People that were wanting to do these computer services contracts, they'd give so much and their lobbyists would say, you know, they had to hire lobbyists when Siegelman came. You know,
right.
So we never had to hire lobbyists. Suddenly, when Siegelman and lobbyists would say, that's not going to cut it. Give at least $10,000 if you want to be in the hunt for these contracts.
Right.
Because one thing Siegelman did was, Siegelman really is a professional politician, in a way I don't have a problem with that if he, you know, public service, and Siegelman was a hard-working official.
Right.
You know, Bob James liked to go duck hunt a lot.
Yeah.
Siegelman, you know, he woke up and he may have spent part of the time doing some naughty business, but right. He was on the job. It became to him, and I do some biographical parts of him in the book, mm-hmm. where some of his people told me, like, in the race against Paul Hubbert that he lost, I believe 1990, he learned how important campaign contributions
right.
were.
Up to that point, he was reluctant to ask for money, like I think most of us would
yeah.
be. I mean, but a politician, that's the meat and butter of your life. According to your book, after Siegelman got beat, you know, he was kind of like Wallace was after he got beat by Patterson. He wasn't going to be outdone again.
Yeah.
He turns a big corner and he becomes the extraordinary fundraiser of all time.
I think a lot of people like can still be reluctant but do it in a way. It got known, I mean, it was either give or die.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Give or forget it. And he had, there's a scene with the whole real biddle, Jim Allen comes
right.
in, and Siegelman has, according to the prosecutors, laid out pretty well that, like, this is when Siegelman was running against Bob James, and,
mm-hmm.
and Jim Allen had supported, I believe, Bob James, and there was some story that came out in the paper where Jim Allen needed this state road for like $25 million to his toll bridge, or it was going
right.
to collapse, and so Siegelman summons him really to Birmingham to some antique store and basically just gets in his face and says, you're going to give me this much. He just orders him, and it's an unusual scene, but I've had people during the trial said, Eddie, you could have contractors stretched around the courthouse who could tell the same stories. Where Siegelman became like a threatening fundraiser, and that's when you cross the
right.
line. And one thing, he ran for governor against Bob James. So that's a big,
right.
biggest guy you run for in Alabama.
Right.
Well, the very next year, he does the lottery. He really banked his entire political career.
On
even,
that one,
those are all these stories at the time
right.
saying after the lottery referendum lost that Siegelman is doomed. This is his. So what he had was he had essentially two huge campaigns one year after another.
Right.
So the Alabama's political funding, the individuals who, you know, have the money to do that,
right.
they were getting hit up. 1 year, and darn it, they were getting hit up hard, hard, hard the next year.
Yeah.
And it was so important, this lottery foundation for Siegelman. It was his political career, and that's almost like his life or death. It'd be like, you know, in a way, if you had to run every year to continue doing what you
right.
do, that would be tough on you. A politician, hopefully if you lose, you can go back to doing something else.
He was crushed when he lost that first campaign.
That lottery campaign.
Yeah.
And the
governor. Yeah, and the lottery thing crushed him, too.
Because he's out in the wilderness, whereas other people go back to a job. Siegelman is technically a lawyer, but he's not really.
Now, that's another story, too. The Cherry Givens Law Firm and the wonderful 4 years that they sent him big, fat checks, ostensibly to make up for the cases that he was working on before he became the governor.
What happened is, Siegelman was an of counsel. It's kind of common. He was not a partner in the law firm. Really, what he was an ambulance chaser. A pass. He would get political cases, like he would call on people and try to get their cases, say, I can represent you. He would literally, seated, he would take those plaintiffs, introduce them to Cherry Givens, people in Mobile or Dothan. they would do the case and Siegelman would be gone. You know, Siegelman was not going to do any of the court work.
He was actually just sort of an agent for the law firm in a sense.
Yeah.
He would go out and solicit customers, pass them along to the law firm, and the law firm would do the actual legal work.
That was it, yeah.
And he would get a percentage.
His ethics forms would then show that he had never made a whole lot of money doing it. Suddenly, and this is what gets interesting, he becomes governor. I think it was October 1997 that he is no longer associated with the Terry Givens firm or these tobacco laws. This story, it was hard to tell. I hope I told it well because it gets complicated in a lot of ways. And one thing you need to know about is how law partnerships work. And I've got a father as a lawyer and a brother. If you ask any lawyer if they're with a law firm and they're a partner, which Siegelman wasn't. So Siegelman didn't have any right to any partnership money. But when they leave, say, to go to another firm, that very day you settle everything.
Yeah.
You know, or within a couple of weeks.
Right. And you're not going to stretch it out for 4 years.
No. Well, they didn't stretch it out 4 years. They didn't even start it for 4 years. Siegelman, they weren't paying him. You know, it was sort of a casual relationship where he was on their letterhead. And then some things happened where Siegelman literally, and this is to me the worst thing that he did, and he wasn't prosecuted for it. You know, some of the worst things he did, I argue, weren't in the prosecution because to save his house, but received at least $1.4 million in legal fees during his 4 years as governor. Now, explodes anything before or since. And a lot of that came from from Cherry Givens. Which, first, why would Cherry Givens be giving him so much money? They didn't sign it till 01 or 02 or something like that. And then he went 3 to 4 years after he left the firm. Why did they suddenly start paying him? It's interesting that after he became governor, he secretly settled a lawsuit under his orders, really. The administration secretly settled a lawsuit with the University of South Alabama that Siegelman had once been part of. It's a tobacco lawsuit.
Right.
The Cherry Givens was to get $2.8 million out of that settlement. After that settlement is finalized, Siegelman and Cherry Givens do a severance contract, which, had it been required to be done, should have been done back in 97. But it gets kind of complicated, but I hope I explain it well in the book. And you know, Siegelman, he made a lot of money, and it's hard to tell because of ethics forms. You can't always tell the maximum. He had to change his ethics forms. He would write something. I would find something. He would have to go back and change it.
Amend his.
He was constantly amending his forms as reporters found out new things. But he made over at least $1.4 million, I believe, in legal fees while he was governor. And he claimed it was for when he wasn't governor.
In case you're just joining us, we're talking to Eddie Curran, who is the author of The Governor of Goat Hill, Don Siegelman, the reporter who exposed his crimes and the hoax that suckered some of the top names in journalism. How can people get a copy, Eddie?
Yeah, listen, I had a small publisher. I'd already spent all my life on this. I decided to self-publish. I have a website, simple enough, Eddie Curran.
That's C-U-R-R-A-N.
Yeah, .com. People can order it through there like PayPal, or they can send me a check or whatever, and I can personally sign it to them. It's also, Amazon.com has it. I don't get as much when people order off Amazon,
right. But
they can. It's also available on Kindle and Nook through there. Books a Million, I've sold them a good many copies, and Books a Million carries it. There's some store, you know, some Barnes & Nobles may have it, but if you want to get a signed copy, you know, the best way is to go to my website, and I'll... As I argue, I think if our stories hadn't come out when they did, if we'd waited like another year to find out, the things they would have done, they would have been in real trouble. I think they should thank us for stopping them before they got too far. But I do think the book has some humor in it.
Yeah, it does. And once again, one of the things that astonished me is that all of a sudden, and again, you got to give Siegelman credit for this, somehow he manages to spin this so that it is now Karl Rove, GOP-inspired plot to destroy Siegelman.
To eradicate him as the most powerful Democrat.
The top Democrat.
According
in the
state. To this sort of story, the storyline.
Yeah.
Is that, well, first of all, it came from this woman named Jill Simpson, who is an unusual woman, lawyer, not very successful at all, with severe financial problems up in Rainesville she's from. And somehow she gets connected to an old friend of Siegelman's named Mark Bollinger, as I describe in the book. And she does this affidavit, and she ends up kind of working with Scrushy and Siegelman, and she's all, you know, secretly kind of dealing with them.
Right.
And she does this affidavit, which was never filed in a court of law. It was given to Siegelman and Scrushy's people and then passed on to the New York Times and Time Magazine and such. And the bulk of the affidavit involves a KKK meeting up in Scottsboro right after the 2002 election. And it is quite bizarre and sort of Also in the affidavit, say there's a fourth K, Coral for Coral Rove. She claims to have been involved in sort of a conference call where she heard people say that Coral was taking care of Siegelman. Everyone involved denies the whole story. One of them was Terry Butts, who was actually Scrooge's lawyer.
Right.
And he says, you know, this woman's like a drunk fiction writer. A man named Bill Canary, whose wife is Laura Canary, who was a U.S. attorney, had never been in the, it was Bob Riley's son's law office is where this call, you know, supposedly they received this call.
Supposedly took place, yeah.
And he was had never been there. He was out of town. He's the one that supposedly said something about Karl Rove. But sort of the justification, as Siegelman says, is that, well, Siegelman has come up with many different stories about one reason why Karl Rove would want to get him. A, that Siegelman says that he was thinking about running for president, and Bush was real scared of Siegelman, you know, this defeated, scandal-plagued Alabama governor.
I can see how that'd be a big political threat.
And they kind of portray Siegelman as the Democratic colossus in Alabama. Of course, he'd already been beaten by Riley.
Right.
Okay. Lucy Maxley, everyone knew, was going to be the next Democratic gubernatorial candidate.
Right.
Siegelman was essentially washed up. But according to the story, and it's as portrayed in Time Magazine, the New York Times, 60 Minutes, Siegelman was he was it. And for some reason, Karl Rove got involved in having to make sure that Siegelman didn't make it back. And
that he was neutralized.
Yeah, that he was removed from. And why Karl Rove would have cared, A, he would have had, like with any conspiracy, it would have had to involve people at the top, career officials of the Justice Department. I'm talking about a chain of command that could come into 100.
Right.
And these people never heard from it. It's because Karl Rove, whether you like him or not, he's controversial. He's got that kind of omniscient, omnipotent reputation,
right.
Dirty politics. So you can sort of blame him for the problems in Japan with the nuclear facility. There's some people who would believe it. And so I think in part because of his reputation, and Siegelman was forever pointing at Bob Riley as being, and Riley was going, why does he do this? And the state media was no longer paying attention because they knew it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Suddenly you had Karl Rove, who's a much bigger, you know, Bob. If Bob Riley, that's not even a New York Times worthy story.
Right.
And the New York Times had not been covering this at all. Suddenly they were to do 20 stories, 20 op-eds and editorials and op-eds. And 60 Minutes did a piece where Jill Simpson came on and her story ballooned to where she says that Karl Rove had asked her to follow Siegelman, capture him photographically having extramarital sex. She said she did follow Siegelman for 3 or 4 months and was paid for this. She can produce no records.
Right.
You know, first it's she overheard Karl's name on a phone call, and then it grows into she's his secret agent.
Right. And the next thing, I guess the next thing she would have been his love slave or something. Who knows? The one thing you can say about Siegelman with all of the stuff that he obviously was involved in and all the dirty dealings is the one good thing you can say about Siegelman is he apparently never was unfaithful to his wife. So that'd be about the most ridiculous way to try to trap Siegelman. According to all the research you've done, the easiest way to have just been have a big pile of money with a string attached to it that you could pull along the street, and maybe he'd chase that. But that was sad to me to see the national media think this is some big scandal. And I'm thinking, what would matter?
Well, I also think it was insulting in a way to the Alabama media.
Yeah.
We've covered this, and as Brett Blacklich, who's going to be, he's one of Pulitzer for his coverage of the two-year system, he told me once, he said, you know, if Karl Rove was involved, that would be a big story. We would be interested.
You would have known it.
Yeah, or if we found out about it, we would be jumping on it too.
Yeah.
Fantasy, it's a farce, and what troubles me is, you know, I like the New York Times. I go to it on the website all the time. Time Magazine, you know, I've gotten that for many, you know. The reason I wrote a good bit about that part of it was that I was really astonished that these news sources that I've respected, you know, I'm not saying everything they get is right or wrong or their editorial position, everything is right or wrong, but their reporting was, they really were just handed a story by Siegelman's people, and instead of really analyzing it, they liked the storyline too good not to go with it. It was the Karl Rove after Don Siegelman, and they didn't analyze it as a common sense approach. Why would he give a damn?
Yeah.
I wrote this book on Don Siegelman. I should want to say that he is the Colossus.
Really?
He was worthy of all this national effort from the Republicans' highest things because he was so powerful. In fact, you should read my book because he was a potential presidential candidate. You know? But the fact is, it's ridiculous that Karl Rove would care less.
Yeah, it's sad. It's like they were given a press release from Don Siegelman, and they said, oh, well, okay, That must be right.
That really is about what it was.
It's kind of like, even more so than the Dan Rather deal, when he gets this bogus document, and instead of checking it like any first-year journalism student would have done, he just goes with it because he'd like for it to be true.
I think these guys, whoever did that, I think did a very good job of falsifying the documentation. I mean, like a, whereas Jill Simpson's a nincompoop.
But now, of course, these guys are pretty good at hiding stuff. I mean, your book is loaded with all these places that you had to ferret out information because they'd done such a good job of squirreling it away. Maybe they're better press release writers than we give them credit for being. And made a more plausible case than those of us who are been in Alabama and know what the heck's going on, that we could see through it. But somebody from, maybe it was a slow news day and it had Karl Rove in them.
But it continued. The New York Times continued on covering the matter.
Yeah, they chased it for a while.
A long time. And in fact, they've come down when there was folks were complaining about the two-year investigation. They did a story like, it's sort of a like victims, like the Democratic Party. The New York Times, I make this case sometimes, they don't really understand Alabama. They view us in a civil rights capacity.
Right.
And they see the Democrats now as this sort of idealistic party that's fighting this losing battle and
champion
getting won over by Republicans.
Man.
And what they don't understand is, whether you agree with the Democratic Party nationally, I think there's definitely an ideology. I think Obama has an ideology.
Right.
He may not agree with it, but he believes in it, and that's
right.
He's trying to pass it. The Alabama Democratic Party had no ideology. They were the most corrupt, infested organization in the world. And
there's a section in there where you described their philosophy. It was like, we want to be reelected. We want at all costs to keep the Republicans from getting any power whatsoever. And we want to make a lot of money.
They had to hold on to the legislature. That was it. Yeah. And so you have people like Roger Bedford, Lowell Barron, these people, who are just accustomed to doing such brazen act, you're just shocked. You know, the old Lowell Barron going 105 miles an hour or something and getting ticketed by a municipal policeman and then having a bill passed saying municipal policemen
can't give tickets to legislators on the way to the
session. On the highway, or can't give tickets to anybody on the highway.
Yeah.
I forget what it was. Something crazy like that.
Well, Eddie, the book is absolutely fascinating, and it really is. I've never been an investigative reporter. I've worked in radio my whole adult life, but I remember following this story, and the way that you show us what it's like from the inside, going through documents, looking for these things. You got to be part detective, maybe a little Hercule Poirot, to chase this money trail, who profit, to figure out what's going on. And I think for journalists, this is a fascinating book, because especially for young journalists, because it gives them an idea of it's not all glamour. It's not like it is in the movies. This is long hours slogging away, pouring through column after column after column of figures.
But it can be exciting when you come across the right thing.
And
I wanted to write that. I would hope young journalists would like it. And I would also hope that it would give regular readers who just used to, they've been reading newspapers all their life, who might read this thing and say, I didn't know that's how it works.
Yeah,
I wanted to write about the process and what I went through as much as I want to write about Siegelman, to tell you the truth. I wanted to have it my story as a reporter's story as much as, about Siegelman. And then again, wrote about the trial. Wipe me out, that's for sure. Kill me. But
this is definitely a labor of love. How long did it take you to write the book?
It's like, how women don't like to be asked how old they are. I thought I could do it in like 3 months. I mean, it took me several years. I had chapters I had to pull out and cut and stuff. But as far as the price, it's come down.
Oh, well, good.
I was originally selling them for,
because
the paperback
the
is $33.95, but I'm selling them for $20. And I have some hardbacks, but I had to pay more for them.
Sure.
I'm selling them for $40 in there, but that's just because I bought these in bulk.
And when you buy a hardback book, you always pay more than you do for the paperback edition.
And I couldn't afford to buy as many in bulk to get the
deal. Yeah. Okay. And if you buy them through your website, eddiecurran.com, then they get them autographed.
They have a means to, they can email me, has my email. You can do PayPal.
Okay.
And if the PayPal comes in and I'll do a message. I even pay taxes or remit taxes.
That's good, because I'm hoping you're filing those papers properly. That you learned from our former governor.
The 20th of every, I don't want to be the investigative reporter who didn't pay his taxes.
There you go.
I got every day the 20th of the month comes around, so I got to do my.
And it is a compelling read too. I know people kid about, wow, this is a big book, several hundred pages, but it's never a dull story.
And
you get to the end of a chapter and go, what's going to happen next?
Yeah.
Where's this trail going to lead the next? It's like following a very, very complicated crossword. Well, Eddie, thank you for taking time.
Thanks for having me.
Eddie Curran, our guest today on The Bookshelf on WTBF. We'll see you next Sunday, same time, and on our website on thebookshelf.biz. Until then, thanks for listening and God bless.